This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, a conversation with the province's progressive conservative leader about his plans for Cape Breton if his party wins the next election. A Sydney Mines native tells us about his impressive weather system and an eerie wind warning that rumbles through the highlands up north. And speaking of the weather, the Highland Arts Theatre says, here comes the sun. These stories coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Party leader Tim Houston says he came up with a new word during the province's recent Progressive Conservative AGM, solutionist. He says that means he wants to find solutions in areas where the government is falling short for Cape Bretoners and all Nova Scotians. And he starts out by talking about the ups and downs of being a politician.
I was elected in 2013 and then re-elected in 2017, became leader in 2018. And It's an interesting profession for sure, because you carry people don't come to their MLA on their best day. They usually come when they need some assistance, you know, with something, whether it's dealing with the government or whatever the case may be. So you're always it's incredibly gratifying, because you can help people. You know, and there's days when people come and you say, there's a government program for that. There's something we can do. I can help you with that. That's a great feeling. There's other days when people come and they have an issue that you completely agree with them, but there's just nothing you can do. And there's other times still where you just don't think there's a role for government. So you kind of get to see everything, and that's a big, it's a burden that I take very seriously. MLAs take that very serious, that they, you know, they're there to serve the people. And when you can't help the people, it weighs on you. But, I love it. There's highs and there's lows, but I mean, overall, the ability to serve the community is a very, very good feeling.
So what do you think of the province's handling of COVID-19 under the direction of Dr. Robert Stranga? Is this a time when parties will try to find common ground and just put some of their differences aside for something this important?
Yeah, I think early on when the pandemic came, we made the decision that as a caucus, we would obviously support public health. That meant supporting the premier. So we knew, I identified early, that it's really important that Nova Scotians knew that their community leaders, that their elected leaders, were all pointing the same direction, on the same page, and that was looking out for Nova Scotians. So we made a decision early on that we would just support public health and support the premier, and we kept that through all the way. And I think that's been, a lot of people have noticed that, but I think it's just been, nobody wants kind of anything to be perceived as bickering when you're trying to get through a pandemic and just trying to literally survive in most cases. So that's a decision we made, and we've stayed true to that. We obviously put a lot of thought into different things that could, programs or whatever, and shared those with the government behind the scenes, and we put out a plan on ready for what's next on the economy, startup, ready for what's next, and a return to schools. Way back in, you may remember, in the summer, there was a lot of anxiety about the return to schools, and still is. But we've tried to maintain just be supportive of public health. That's been our goal all along, and we've done that, and I think it was the best decision.
So when it comes to choosing your battles when you're in opposition, it seems interesting. Sometimes certain issues are on the radar for a long time, and sometimes it's just a blip on the radar. And I'm just wondering, when voters ask you about these things, you know, which your priority items are, does it ever lead into a discussion about partisan politics?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, partisan politics can be pretty brutal. And I try to, not really interested in that. I mean, there's a reason I left a career to put my name on a ballot, and it wasn't to just bicker with people. But I think people would see when they look, certainly in my time as leader, I try not to criticize without putting solutions forward. We've been talking about our AGM. I said we'd be a party of solutionists, and people kind of laugh, because solutionist is not really a real word, but it's a frame of mind. And we have challenges, we have incredible opportunities, but so I think for me, on the, like, we point out things where government can act differently and do things differently, and then we put a solution forward. That's the mantra we try to stay true to. Sometimes you just gotta call something what it is. We've done that on things like the Ferry file and the conflict of interest that was happening, stuff like that. But for the most part, on the policy stuff around healthcare, mental health, seniors, all this type of things, these important issues, we've identified problems and been clear about acknowledging the problems. I think it's really important government acknowledge and accept problems. Don't hide from them. But at the same time, we put out very detailed policy ideas. We're not a soundbite party. We actually do the research and then put out what we think is possible. So that's kind of how we approach that part. I try to steer clear of the partisan, well, because you're from that party, you're wrong. No, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what's best for Nova Scotians.
So now that Nova Scotia has a new premier and a new cabinet, several cabinet ministers announcing that they are not reoffering in the next election, what does this mean for your party's approach in making sure the government is held accountable? And, you know, is it back to the drawing board, or is it, are you responding, looking at this as more of an opportunity to connect with Nova Scotians?
That's a bit of both. I mean, the work still needs to be done, but I do think there's an opportunity there. I wish Ian Rankin, the new premier, nothing but the best. I hope he does a good job for Nova Scotians, because we in this province we can't afford to waste any time. So I hope he does a good job. Of course, I hope he's not there for too long, because I think there's a provincial election in the air. But in terms of our caucus, we have 18 incumbent MLAs. Every single one of them is reoffering. No other party can say that, and you're quite right. On the Liberal benches, pretty mass exodus happening over there. They're moving along. So our caucus is energized. We're ready to go. I mean, we know there's a lot of work to be done, and we want to do the work. So we'll just continue to put ideas forward to share our thoughts with Nova Scotians, and we just ask them to look. Just take a look at the PC party. And I think when they look objectively, I'm confident that they will like what they see, but we need to get them to look, and that's the work we're trying to do.
So healthcare, obviously something your party's been speaking about, especially lately, Tim, and can you talk about doctor recruitment and doctor retention, especially here in Cape Breton? And on top of that, Cape Breton hospitals have the highest mortality rates in the country. What do you have to say about that?
Some shocking statistics coming out of Cape Breton, for sure. I think for 3 years in a row, like very dire mortality rates. So that's very sad. So the way we've approached the healthcare file overall, and healthcare is about half the budget, so there's lots of moving parts in there. But so in the summer, we put out a plan we called Dignity for Seniors, and it focused on nursing homes and more single rooms, you know, more rooms, more staff, like really just, and a new level of care, like really just what can we do to make sure that our seniors live with dignity? And then in the fall, we followed that up with a plan for universal mental health care, which just said, like, no matter how much money you have in your pocket, you should be able to access addictions and mental health support in this province. So there's a lot of work to do there, but we put out a very detailed plan as to what we would do. Open up the billing codes. There's people who can help Nova Scotians. They're nurses with additional training. They're psychologists. They're family counselors. But they don't all work for the Nova Scotia Health Authority. And what we said we would do is we'd mobilize all of those resources for the benefit of Nova Scotians and open up the billing codes so that if you're qualified and you help a Nova Scotian, then you can bill and be paid for it. So these are the types of things we're talking about. They're innovative. That's probably, somebody said, that's the most progressive plan in the country. So we're laying it out there. And then most recently we did what we call Hope for Health. And that's all about more access to primary care. So it's about 55,000 Nova Scotians today who don't have a family doctor. A shocking number, and it's up from about 6,000 just a couple of years ago. So the trend is very, very bad. And what we've said we would do is for all of those people, we would immediately set them up with virtual care options. So if you don't have a doctor, you at least have the opportunity to connect with a healthcare professional virtually. So these types of things will offer a lot of support. In terms of recruitment and retention specifically, because you can't recruit unless you can retain, there's a whole cultural thing there where it's, I think it's a difficult place to be a healthcare professional the last few years. we've got to change the culture so that we're listening to healthcare professionals, respecting them, working with them, not against them. This means putting local decision-making ability back in communities, all kinds of moving parts to that. But I know we can do a lot better in recruitment once we do better in changing the culture and retaining. And I think there's only one party that can kind of hit reset on the culture thing, and that's our party.
So what do you think are the challenges for doctors when basically they can work anywhere they want in the country for the most part? What are they looking for when they're thinking about moving to a place like Cape Breton? What's here for them that would attract them here, and what's not here that may discourage them from setting up here on the island?
I think when you look at anyone where they make a decision where they want to work, quality of life is very significant. Especially to newer doctors, millennials in general, Gen Zers and stuff, the quality of life is really, really important. And Cape Breton has that. I mean, for sure, Cape Breton would rank very, very highly on offering a quality of life. So once you get past that, then you start to say, well, what's the work environment like? Am I going to be supported? Am I going to be listened to? Am I going to be paid properly? So all of these things kind of come into play, and of course we need to, for family doctors in particular, I would also say for nurses and lots of other healthcare professionals, we've got to look at the compensation package, because I don't think it's ever going to be wise for Nova Scotia to try just rely on a bidding war. Somebody else will always pay more if that's the route you go, but the pay has to be fair, it has to be respectful, and I think that needs to be reset as well. But above all of that, it's the culture, it's the ability to feel and to know that you can direct not only patient care but lots of things around your professional life. So right now, I mean, the temperature in a room in a healthcare facility in Cape Breton could be controlled from Halifax. The pens and papers you buy, controlled from Halifax. All the way down through, to recruitment of physicians done from another area. There's lots we can improve, and I think that needs to be the focus, just so that healthcare people know they'll have a good quality of life, they'll be paid properly, and they'll be respected.
So there are a few other topics to cover here, Tim. I wish we could stay with healthcare a little bit longer, but another very important topic to Cape Bretoners, I don't mean for an abrupt change, but equalization payments, and that was a top campaign issue for the most recent municipal election, and that can be a complicated topic for people who don't follow it closely. Can you break it down into simple terms, and how does the system work, and is Cape Breton getting a fair share or a good deal, and what would you do differently if you were in charge?
Yeah, well, the concept of equalization, and I think this goes back even to the formation of Canada, the concept of equalization is that no matter where you live, in Nova Scotia or in Canada, you have access to the same level of healthcare as somewhere else, the same level of education as somebody who lives somewhere else. So they recognize that different parts of the province, different parts of the country even, need a little bit more money to make that happen. So that's the general concept around equalization. So I know there's a move in Cape Breton that looks at the amount of money that comes into Nova Scotia overall from the federal government in the name of equalization, and then says, well, here's the share that we should get of that money. And I understand that, but I think in a lot of ways some of the arguments I've heard are I don't necessarily agree with. But what I do agree with is that the provincial government needs to do a better job of making sure that its relationship with municipalities is fair. So what I've said we would do, because equalization money comes from the federal government to the province and then from the province to the municipalities. So there's an underlying agreement, a contract between the province and each of the municipalities. That contract is decades old and it needs to be, renegotiated, modernized and freshened up. And I've said I would do that as premier. And as proof, as a show of good faith, well, we're renegotiating that contract, which covers many things. It covers justice, education, It covers certain roads, who's responsible for certain roads in areas. Is it the municipality? Is it the province? There's all kinds of moving parts that go back and forth. But so renegotiate that whole agreement. And as it's being renegotiated, as a show of good faith, to show that I'm not going to drag my feet, I would double the payments from the province to the municipalities. So, like, there's more money for the municipalities while we're negotiating in good faith what the agreement should look like longer term. So I think it's more at the focus needs to be more between the province and the municipalities as opposed to a certain region looking at what comes nationally and saying that's the share we should get of that. Because don't forget, the money that comes in nationally into our province covers healthcare and all kinds of schools and all this type of stuff. So we can have a discussion about how we better deliver healthcare. And that, I think that's part of the renegotiation of the existing contract.
And if we can move on to another topic here, a report from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives on Child Poverty. Cape Breton has the highest rates of child poverty in Nova Scotia, and the province has the highest rates in Atlantic Canada. How are politicians like yourself affected when you hear about people making real decisions? Does the family pay for food this week, or do we go ahead and buy some heating oil?
Oh, it's incredibly sad. Because the statistics on child poverty are shocking. I'm a parent and just a community member. I mean, it's incredibly sad. When you're talking about child poverty, you're talking about family poverty. So it's much broader. So I think that there's many housing insecurity is an issue, food insecurity is an issue. All of these things kind of put a lot of pressure on families and on children. So we need to have opportunities and economic development, and there's things that we can do for that. But also right away, I think, back to the plan we put out there for universal mental health care. Under that plan, that would make sure, because we know that has an impact on physical health and mental health, living in poverty for sure. But under that plan, at least people would have access to a support network for their mental health, for their primary health care. But ultimately, we need to grow our economy so that there's opportunities for people. And that's the part that it's when you look at Cape Breton and what's happening there, and you think about the rich tradition of hard work and strong communities. It's incredibly sad what's happened there.
It seems you stepped it up a little bit, stepping outside the box recently. Your team was able to get an ad during the Super Bowl. Where did that idea come from, and how did you make that happen?
Well, we just know that I want Nova Scotians to know where I stand as a leader, kind of what matters to me. I want them to know what the PC Party stands for. So we're just asking them to take a look. In a world where people don't have a lot of time to talk about politics, to look at politics, to read policy, people are just busy. They're just trying to survive. So, but we encourage them to look. When the election comes, they have alternatives, and I just want them to. I just ask for them to look at those alternatives through a fair lens. That's all. So we know that. I have a branding issue in the sense that just not a lot of people know who I am, and I accept that, and I work harder to give people the opportunity to know me. And I was down in we did the Hope for Healthcare announcement in Sydney, but I was in Glace Bay a couple of weeks ago too, just knocking on doors, just talking to people, just seeing what's on their minds, how they're feeling about things, and just those are the conversations that I love. But I know I have a lot of work to do, and we're up to doing it.
So when you talk about knocking on doors in a close-knit community like Glace Bay, did you have name recognition there, or did you feel like a stranger?
Actually, I was quite surprised, to be honest, at how, of course, when people open the door, when you knock on the door, people aren't expecting you anyway. It kind of catches them by surprise, like, is that somebody at the door type thing? So you have to, and then they come out and you have a mask, so there's a whole another situation. I know some of my friends, it's hard to recognize too when I see them with their mask on. So, but I would say I was pleasantly surprised with the number of people that even in those circumstances opened up the door and said, hey, I recognize you. Probably a function of the ads we've been running and stuff, but that's, you know, and then just having discussions with them. But certainly there's big concerns about healthcare. There's big concerns about economic opportunities.
And you mentioned earlier a new word that came out of the annual general meeting. You talked about the word a solutionist. And what kind of solutions can you find for people in Nova Scotia and in Cape Breton?
We listen to people. We reach out. We try to understand their experiences. We reach out to people working in the area, you know, frontline people, and say, like, what's working, what's not working, what would you do if you had the chance? And we just pull it all together. So really, you know, government for the people has to come from the people. And if you don't listen to the people of the province, then you're not going to get good government. So we've kind of watched that happen in this province over the last few years, where we've generally had a government of one. Lots of people haven't felt respected and listened to. So just by really doing the work, and it takes a lot of work to research and understand and look what's happening in other areas. So that's what we're doing, and then we're presenting it to Nova Scotians, and we're just saying to them, take a look, let us know what you think. If you have ideas to make it better, we are all ears, because we want what's best for the province.
And just one last thing with that word solutionist, do you think somewhere in there will there be another Stay the Blazes Home?
I don't know. That was a pretty good one, actually. But we're putting together a team of solutionists, word or not, and I think the people of Cape Breton are certainly well represented by our caucus colleagues there, and Keith, Brian, Murray, and Alan, and the team of candidates that we're putting together, with obviously John White and Glace Bay and Trevor Boudreau in Richmond. Really, really proud of the voices that are stepping up from Cape Breton to say they care about the community and they have ideas too. So we'll keep building the team of solutionists and putting ideas before Nova Scotians. And then at some point in time, there'll be an election and they'll get to have their say on them.
The Highland Arts Theatre is taking a peek over the snowbanks and gets March underway with a production called Here Comes the Sun. Donnie Antle of the Coast Newsroom caught up with Wesley Colford, the theatre's executive director.
So obviously all of last year and all of this year has been such an uncertain time, and it's been wonderful that we're now allowed to have small audiences back at the theatre, but it's been a lot less notice than we normally have, so... the challenge for this season has been putting together shows that are small enough that we can make it work with the restrictions, and also hopefully things that people will really love. So when we started thinking about that, we thought normally this time of year we'll do a big, lavish Broadway musical or an original musical, and that's not really something that's possible because of the number of people that would have to be on stage and the cost of those big shows and all kinds of things. So we thought, what can we do with some of our most talented singers that is small, intimate, and speaks to what we all need right now, which I think is a little spark of joy. And so we put together this new musical review. It's called Here Comes the Sun, and we've tagged it as a musical review of light, joy, and hope for a brighter tomorrow. So it's a whole collection of songs, some of which you'll know very well, some of which might be new to people, but they're from all over the last century, and hopefully songs that are just going to make you smile the entire time.
So let's talk a little bit about the songs in the show. Now, are these going to be from musical theater? Are we going to be doing some show tunes? Are there going to be pop tunes in there as well? What's the mix
pretty,
of music?
It's a pretty big mix. There's about 20 songs, and the show's about an hour, so we tried to cram as much in as we could. There's musical theater, there's pop, there's folk songs, a couple of Cape Breton classics, some jazz standards, a wide cross-section. We didn't want it to be just one thing. Hopefully there's something for everyone, and hopefully everything is for everyone ultimately. But it's a really nice mix, and you know, songs that are from the 1920s and from the 2020s. So it's quite a range.
So good mix right across the board for all audiences.
Yeah, I think definitely something that, you know, any generation will recognize some favorites. I don't want to spoil too much, but obviously the titular song "Here Comes the Sun" by the Beatles is one of our big group numbers. Well, again, I don't want to give away too many, but maybe I can tease a couple. If you like Rodgers and Hammerstein, the beautiful anthem "You'll Never Walk Alone." We've got a little bit of Dolly Parton. We've got a little bit of Paul Williams, just an old-fashioned love song. A couple of other really great ones that I think people will love that I don't want to give away.
So the cast, obviously, for this show is going to be smaller than we've come to expect from a Hat musical review, obviously. How big of a cast are we talking about?
So we've got 5 performers, and or singers, I should say, I guess. And then there's a band as well, which we're really excited to get to work with all of these fantastic performers. The singers I can spoil because that's been already released. It's going to be featuring the fabulous Morgan Reed, who people might remember from The Happy Prince and The Rotary Show. Those are the last shows she was in 2018. Catherine Woodford has been in all kinds of shows and a fabulous Glace Bay-based performer. I'm sure people remember her from shows like She Loves Me and I Love You, Perfect Now Change. Wonderful young vocalist who we're so lucky to have. She's supposed to be in school, but because of COVID, she's doing school online. So we get to have her a little bit longer as Mackenzie Secchi. And she's been in all kinds of shows as well, including the remount of Heart of Steel a couple of years ago. And last but not least, the fabulous Matt Campbell, who I think the last show he was in was called Swonderful 2 years ago, but he's been in all kinds of things as well through the Hat history. And I will be performing in it as well.
Right on. And of course, Matt is my favorite director of all time because his production of Dracula at the Boardmore was so much fun to do.
You were great in that show. It was a fantastic production.
Oh, well, thank you. No, that's all down to his direction, actually.
I'm glad you said that.
Now, so this show, sort of bringing light into dark days, how has the pandemic been for you, both like personally and as the artistic director of a theater?
Sure. I mean, I think it's been definitely a very dark year for everyone. And for me, at least, it feels like every time it feels like we're just getting around the corner and then something else happens that just makes everything that much more difficult or perhaps that much more bleak. But there is hope, and I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm hoping that will keep growing. Certainly the fact that the vaccine is well on its way is some comfort, and I think over the rest of through the spring and through the summer, hopefully people will start to feel more secure and more like they can somewhat resume normal activities. In terms of the theater, it's certainly been a roller coaster because last April, after everything was really, we were realizing how monumental a change this was going to be, we thought that the theater was going to go bankrupt. We really thought that there would be no more Hats before even the end of the summer. And thankfully, in enormous part due to the generosity of thousands of donors who have contributed little bits of money every month, whatever they can afford, to our Radical Access program, I'm so happy to say we did not go bankrupt. We still are operating, and in fact, between August and December of 2020, we had 7 full productions and I think 132 performances all in all, which is extraordinary. Obviously, very, very small audiences, everybody physically distanced, masks, intense cleaning procedures, all of the things you expect in this day and age. But the fact that we could do anything was really a miracle and so much more than I expected. So the fact that we're able to get back at it, and we just finished, well, today is the last day for our first production of 2021, which is a play called Tough Call by Alex Poirier. And we have lots more planned, assuming things continue to go as well as they have been in Cape Breton with epidemiology. We'll be making some more announcements very soon and hopefully continuing through the rest of the year.
Right on. So here's to brighter days ahead. And Here Comes the Sun opens March 2nd, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, March 2nd and to the 13th, which is actually the one-year anniversary of when we found out we would be shut down last year. So hopefully we'll have a better March 13th this year. It's Saturday the 13th, instead of Friday the 13th. So we'll all be hopefully celebrating a much better anniversary. And in the meantime, I hope people come and check out the show. I should say tickets are free thanks to our Radical Access program. So whether you're a donor or not, whether you've been to the theater or not, this is the perfect time. I can pretty much guarantee that everybody will smile at least once, and hopefully you'll be in just a broad grin for the entire hour.
Well, that's great. Well, yeah, thank you very much for your time, Wes. Wesley Colford, the Artistic Director of the Highland Arts Theatre, and the show is called Here Comes the Sun, a musical review of light, joy, and... Sorry.
For a brighter tomorrow.
For a brighter tomorrow. Thank you for your time, Wes.
Thank you, Donnie.
Jonathan Buffett, originally of City Mines, probably knows more about the weather in Cape Breton than just about anyone. The Cape Breton Weather Messenet is a network of 51 home weather stations across the island gathering climate data. The 28-year-old bought his first weather station at 15, and he just kept rolling from there.
The Messenet, Cape Breton Messenet, is a collection of privately owned weather stations across Cape Breton Island and eastern parts of the mainland. It's involved the community to a large extent. People have, shown great interest in weather across Cape Breton. That, you know, they want to know what the microclimate is around the region that they live, and so it's really taken off in the last several years. And open source, you know, the website is free for anyone to use, and that's where the data is available live and in archived form. And so it's been a really nice project, I guess you could say, that everyone in the community has come together to help work on.
And how did this start, Jonathan?
It started years ago. So with my first job when I was 15, I purchased a weather station, the same kind that runs on the network. So that was in 2006. And from there, it just kind of went. Every couple of years, I would add a station and add another one. And by the time around 2014, 2015 came around, I had started to connect with a few other people on Cape Breton Island that also had these weather stations. And we all shared data onto one website. So, you know, one area that people could go to see data from different parts of the island. And around that time is when more people started to find out about it. And the weather in Cape Breton, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more diverse portfolio as far as what we get, you know, from the sweat winds up in Shetty Camp to, you know, the full effect of winter with snowstorms and ice and all that. And then in the summer, we get heat waves, we get high humidity, we can get hurricanes, like just almost anything you can think of happens here. And often it happens in some extreme way. So I think people are fascinated by it for that reason.
When you talk about microclimates, do you think you have an advantage over mainstream media outlets, which are more likely to give more of a general snapshot of the weather in Cape Breton, or they may break it down into a few communities, certainly not as widespread as your system?
That's correct. So in the title, Cape Breton Mesonet, the Mesonet refers to the scale at which each weather station is distanced from one another. And so in this case, it would be, it's usually around 5 to about 15 or 20 kilometers apart. And around the world, we're, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, we're starting to see in different places these mesonet networks of weather stations popping up. And the goal is to be able to observe these patterns that occur in very small scales that aren't detected by, you know, your standard network. A lot of interesting things can be uncovered when you do that. And often it leads to even more questions than answers. But I've learned a lot just by seeing what happens in Cape Breton and really being able to drill down into, you know, each area, each bay and valley, and, you know, the effect that other parts of the island can have as far as terrain and water and whatnot downwind of that area. It's quite interesting.
What are some of the interesting things you discovered about the weather in Cape Breton? What can you say about that?
Yeah, so I think the most exciting thing that I've learned, for one, the sweat winds up around Grand Etang and Shetty Camp, that area, there's an array of weather stations in that area that has really given a more in-depth look into what happens with each one of those events. And so what I found interesting is that not every sweat is exactly the same. So as Grand Etang may get the strongest winds in one event, and then in another event it could be plateau or somewhere further north that ends up with the strongest winds. And they can be highly variable. So right in Shetty Camp, downtown Shetty Camp, you may have an event where they don't really get any wind there, but then you drive 10 kilometers south near Grand Etang, or, you know, 5 kilometers southeast towards Plateau, and it could be, you know, it could be gusting to 70 in Shetty Camp, and then it could be gusting to 150 in Plateau, and you know, we're talking a couple of kilometers away, and you know, to see that with such extreme winds is fascinating to watch. And then another interesting thing that has been uncovered is on the other side of the Highlands. So from kind of Wreck Cove, Inganish, Cape North, Beginner Vale, around Aspie Bay, that whole side of the Highlands, you can actually get in a northwest wind or west to a northwest wind, in certain scenarios, a similar effect as to what happens in Shetty Camp. Now, it's not as extreme as in, you know, the peak wind gusts are not pushing 200 kilometers an hour. They might push 120, 130 or something like that. But they actually end up being a lot more damaging because the infrastructure is not built to withstand that type of wind. And it doesn't happen as often. So you can have one of these, you know, northwest wind events in that area that may have peak gusts around 130 kilometers an hour, and it can knock out the power from Wreck Cove all the way up to Pleasant Bay and Bay St. Lawrence for 2 days. And there's trees down all over the place. I've driven up there after one of these, and I've also been there for one to see it for myself, and it's quite eye-opening. And with the stations that have recently been installed in that area, it has confirmed that this does happen. And if you talk to any locals from that area, all along that area, they will tell you about that. That, you know, they hear, usually they hear it roaring down the mountain before it hits, and then it, you know, just almost like it can come out of nowhere, and then it can be quite damaging if you get a really strong one. And then they do happen from time to time, maybe every couple of years, but certainly not as often as what you see in Shetty Camp.
And can you elaborate on that a bit, please? People living up north, so they hear this wind basically rumbling through the mountains before it hits, and that That sounds pretty eerie and mysterious. Can you talk more about that, Jonathan, please?
Yes. Yeah, so I've actually experienced this myself in Shetty Camp too. But on that side, so what happens is before one of these strong wind events begins, usually they will begin up above near the edge of the mountain and will move down the slope of the mountain quickly. And, you know, you'll hear it, but it's not like you hear it for hours or anything. You'll hear it kind of just before it happens. And it, what you're hearing is the trees and the wind and the roaring as the wind pushes down the mountain. And then when it arrives, it's like a, you know, like a storm. Just that just comes out of nowhere. And we see this reflected in the data as well, where, you know, you can have winds that are variable, almost calm. And then all of a sudden when that front comes through with the high winds, it spikes way up and that's when they begin. So, I've had many people tell me that around on both sides of the Highlands. Now this January, I actually went up to Shetty Camp for one of the Lace Wet Wind events. And just before it struck in Shetty Camp, it was dead calm. And I had looked at the weather station in Plateau, and it was already gusting around 120 kilometers an hour at that site. And then in Shetty Camp, it was still calm. And so I went outside, and I could hear the it almost sounded like a train was coming in from a distance. And you could hear, it was kind of eerie, but you could hear it. And so I hopped in the car, and about a kilometer down the road, all of a sudden, you could feel the wind hitting the car, and that's, the event had begun right then. And so it started near the base of the mountain and moved out towards the coast.
Have you done any research into why this happens? Is this unique in Cape Breton?
Yeah, so there's many reasons that make this happen the way that it does. So I'll try to keep it as not too technical, I guess. But basically, if you can picture the Cape Breton Highland Plateau, just kind of sits in the middle, between the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the Atlantic Ocean, with the Cabot Strait beside it. And so you've just got this high area of land that impedes the flow of wind. And wind that comes out of the southeast or the northwest from either body of water with a storm tends to be very strong. And the Cabot Strait also helps to kind of enhance that flow between, you know, the mountains of northern Cape Breton and the mountains of southern Newfoundland around Port of Basque. So they impede the flow of wind, and by doing so, for example, in a southeast wind in Shetty Camp, you have the center of the storm out over the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and it's pulling wind in towards us from the Atlantic Ocean. And it creates almost like a vacuum just on the western slope of the Highlands there around Shetty Camp. And so because of that difference in air pressure, the air is sucked down off the mountains at very high speeds in order to fill that you know, vacuum, so to speak. That's probably the best way I can describe it. And there's other things that happen in the atmosphere that also play an important role. So this would be a bit more technical, but when you have a storm that's approaching, generally maybe about a kilometer and a half above the earth, the air is a lot warmer up there, and it doesn't mix with the air near the ground. And so it constricts the flow of air over the Cape Breton Highlands, and they just happen to be the right height for this effect you know, to happen. And so that also plays a very important role as well.
So when you talk about these different behaviors of the wind in Cape Breton, if you will, how different communities, you know, they experience it differently. Has Nova Scotia Power ever contacted you or used your information to get a sense of where damage will occur in high winds during storms and give them an idea of, you know, help them with their response time as to where their priority areas are?
I haven't been directly approached for that reason. I don't know, you know, if they use it, they you know, they might use it. I don't know for sure. I know the community around Cape Breton do, but no, I haven't been directly contacted by them. But you know, hopefully they do use it as a a tool to help determine you know, when it might be safe to go out and fix lines or to know, you know, how strong the wind actually was in a certain area. But that would be one of the, you know, possible benefits of having a network like that, where you know, you can actually monitor in great detail each storm event and do a detailed analysis on where the strongest winds were, because it's always different. Each storm is a little bit different, and each event is a little different. And so I'm sure that could be quite useful. Yep. But I haven't been contacted by them, or, you know, to this point anyway.
So for anyone who's on your website there and they choose some random weather stations, maybe, let's say, one in the southeast and one in the northwest, there are some big differences at times in temperatures. And have you noticed anything interesting about fluctuating temperatures in your record-keeping, the weather record-keeping for Cape Breton?
Yeah, so temperature is probably one of the most variable weather parameters in Cape Breton, especially either in the winter time, like, for example, on a clear, calm night where you get pockets of very cold air, you know, in a place like the Margaree Valley, where it could be minus 28 degrees in that valley, and then just a few kilometers away along the coast near Margaree Harbor, it might be only minus 10. We see that quite often. In all different parts of the island there. And then in the summertime, and especially earlier in the summer when the water is still cold, we see huge differences in temperature over very small distances. So a good example of that would be in up around Inganish. This was one that really caught my eye. There's a station in North Inganish, which is kind of on the northeastern side of the North Bay, and then there's another two stations on the southern side of the bay, and they're only about 5 kilometers apart. But you on a hot day, it can be well over 30 degrees in the south and western part of Inganish, and then near the northern part of North Bay, it can be, you know, 10 or 15 degrees colder, and it stays that way the entire day, just due to the wind direction. And we see examples of this in other parts of the island as well. In other ways, say on the west coast of Cape Breton, it can get very warm there even when the wind is off of the water in the summertime. And the water is very warm there as well in the summer. And that's quite unique to Cape Breton as well. So the waters in the Bredour Lake and the Gulf of St. Lawrence often become a lot warmer during the summer than the Atlantic Ocean does. So some of the stations are equipped with water temperature sensors, and we've seen some pretty interesting variations with that as well, especially in Ben-Yon.
So your weather system could be helpful for someone in Sydney, for example. Let's say they want to go up north for a hike, and they could look in nearby communities to check out the weather and see a significant, different weather readings from communities nearby, and that would help them determine which trail they could go to if they want to go to a place a little bit cooler or a little bit warmer, and depending on what time of year it is?
Yeah, I've heard that people use it for pretty much everything. I know a lot of people that, you know, they have boats and they go out on the Bridor Lake. They will check the wind speed and direction from the different stations along the lake, and I'm sure fishermen use it as well. I know in Western Cape Breton, there's a station on Henry Island, which is just off the coast of Fort Hood, and so that's useful for fishermen because it's a station that's, you know, literally out in the water, and conditions out there can be a lot different than even if you're right on the shore. So it can be quite useful for those scenarios.
So most people talk about the weather, and the weather usually comes up in small talk and casual conversation, but it'd be a lot different talking to someone about you. And I'm just wondering, what's that like, you know, if you're having small talk with someone and the weather comes up, they probably don't see it coming with the knowledge that you really have for the weather.
It depends on who I'm talking to. If they know a lot about weather, I can get a bit more technical about it, and or if they're from the area, they might know more than I do about the weather that occurs there, and so I might end up asking them questions about what actually happens there. But I love to talk about weather. I could talk about it all day. So there's been a lot of interesting conversations that have taken place, and it's been a great learning experience for me.
And if I can leave the last word with you about the weather in Cape Breton, any interesting facts or information you'd like to share? And also, how can people learn more about the Cape Breton Mesonet?
I think Cape Breton is the perfect playground to deploy a network of weather stations like this. And I think we have a lot to be proud of here in Cape Breton about our climate, both in how beautiful it can be in the summertime and how stormy and how extreme it can be in the winter. To find the website, you go to capebretonweather.ca. So it's all one word, capebretonweather.ca, and you'll see a live map of the weather stations. And it's an interactive map, so you can zoom in, zoom out. You can pick different data layers. So if you want to see water temperature or high wind speed for the day or anything like that, it's all available there on the site. And archive data is available as well by clicking on each station link has a link to a page of its own. And there's more data there for that station specifically.
That's all for Dialogue this week on the Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.